we ended up third lowest, and the number came out to be 4.76 million square kilometers.
The Arctic sea ice hits its yearly minimum. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 15th of September. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, an Alaskan lawyer helps Gulf residents with their claims against BP.
You're dealing with a huge multinational corporation, and it's in their certainly their financial interest, their shareholders' interest to minimize payments.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
An ocean barge carrying oil field equipment has gone aground along Alaska's North Slope, and responders say the vessel emitted a light sheen in the Beaufort Sea. State environmental regulators say the barge has more than 1,700 gallons of diesel fuel on board. The vessel grounded after the wheelhouse broke loose and settled at the stern. Tom DeRider with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation says no one was injured in the mishap, but a small amount of fuel leaked from a tank. He says the valves on all the tanks were closed and the sheen dissipated. The barge ran aground about 40 miles west of Prudhoe Bay. The sea ice in the Arctic Ocean has begun to expand again. It melted back to its minimum a couple of days ago, according to Mark Serez, head of the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado.
We're at the seasonal minimum for sea ice. It happened just a few days ago. It takes us a while to crunch the numbers and confirm what's happening. And as it turns out, if you look at this over the satellite record, which starts in 1979, we ended up third lowest, and the number came out to be 4.76 million square kilometers.
That's 1.8 square miles. In 2007, the sea ice withdrew a record amount. Although the overall extent of sea ice this year was greater than that of 2007, both the Northwest Passage through Canadian waters and the Northeast Passage above Russia opened up this year. In 2007, only the Canada route opened. The center will publish an analysis of its data in a couple of weeks, but already Serez is willing to say the signs for future years are not good. Each year, more of the thicker ice that has built up over the years has disappeared. This year, a larger amount of older ice drifted west from Canada to the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas.
Some of the thinking was that, well, that might survive the summer melt season because it's thicker. It can take a bigger hit. You know, and if so, that would kind of replenish ice conditions this year, so we'd be a bit better going into autumn. But it didn't happen. It basically all melted. So it really is telling you that things really are changing in the Arctic, and that old multi-year ice just doesn't even survive anymore. So we're heading even into next year. I think we're in kind of worse shape than we even are right now.
Another oddity this year was the presence of ice in the Bering Sea in the spring, even after it pulled back in the Beaufort. But even though the Bering Sea froze up more than usual last winter, it was all what is known as one-year ice, not thick enough to hang around through the summer.
But once spring took hold, that stuff melted out really fast because we knew that, of course, forming late in the year was going to be quite thin, and so once the warmth of spring kicked in, it went fast, and that's, of course, just what we saw.
The survey is based on an average as the ice builds up in some places but is still pulling back in others. There is a slight chance that winds will cause more melting. In the midst of this year's Gulf of Mexico oil spill, many Alaskans turned their thoughts to the spring and summer of 1989 and the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Images of Gulf wildlife and coastline covered in oil were a harsh reminder of the devastating financial and environmental disaster caused by Exxon. In the months since, many Alaskans have traveled to the Gulf, either to lend a hand in the cleanup or to offer moral support. Now that the oil has stopped flowing, Gulf residents have begun to claim economic damages from Deepwater Horizon operator BP. Once again, it's a story Alaskans are all too familiar with. thanks to a 20-year legal battle with Exxon that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. As KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, one lawyer who was on the ground in Prince William Sound following the Exxon spill is now headed to the Gulf to offer advice and support.
Vance Sanders came to Alaska in 1984 to work for the nonprofit public interest law firm Alaska Legal Services Corporation. 5 years later, the Exxon Valdez hit Bly Reef, and then-Governor Steve Cooper, a former ALSC board member, asked Sanders and his colleagues to go to Prince William Sound. As he recalls, it was shortly after the spill, and lawsuits were already being filed against Exxon and even the state of Alaska.
We were asked to go up to Cordova and work with the state and other entities to try to assist in any way that we could with the oil spill.
Sanders says the job mostly consisted of helping people who met Alaska Legal Services income guidelines with paperwork for a class action lawsuit against Exxon. ALSC wasn't involved in arguing the case, but he says working with the spill victims has stuck with him all these years.
It was just so shocking to be there and see the beauty of the sound. I'd been up to Prince William Sound before and been to Cordova, but to see the environmental destruction was just amazing. And the number of people who were affected, it certainly was groundbreaking.
Today, Sanders is in private practice, but remains involved in ALSC as president of its board of directors. He's traveling to Pensacola, Florida this weekend to share his Exxon experience with attorneys gearing up for the legal fight over the Gulf of Mexico disaster. Bonnie Allen is director of training and foundation development at the Mississippi Center for Justice, part of the Gulf State Regional Consortium of Public Interest Lawyers and Advocates.
I think a lot of it will be, for him, will be to just tell the story of what happened.
Allen says many of the lawyers attending the conference were quite young or weren't even born when the Exxon Valdez spill happened. Similar to Sanders' experience 21 years ago, there's a sense of heading into uncharted waters.
That's one thing, is just our own internal organizational planning. How do we best retool and adapt to some new areas of law that we're not generally accustomed to?
And there are other parallels. For instance, the Gulf, especially Mississippi, has a large population of Vietnamese fishermen. Allen says estimates vary, but it's generally accepted that more than 15,000 Vietnamese families make their living in the region's fishing industry. It's been a challenge to reach all of them due to language and cultural barriers.
Many of the older Vietnamese Americans are not all that integrated into a lot of the other groups. Many of them have never turned to government for any kind of public assistance or support.
Sanders says the situation reminds him of the Alaska Native fishermen he worked with in places like Tetitlik and Chiniga Bay following the Exxon spill.
There were people who were subsistence users, for example, who we tried to work with to make sure that they were adequately provided for, as well as the commercial interests that were affected.
Most of all, Sanders says he wants to convey to the advocates that they must prepare themselves for a long legal battle. In addition to the lingering environmental and economic effects of the Exxon Valdez, thousands of claimants in the litigation died before receiving their settlement. Even 20 years later, Sanders has little faith that BP will pay victims of the Gulf spill in a timely manner.
You're dealing with a huge multinational corporation, and it's in their certainly their financial interest, their shareholders' interest to minimize payments. And I'm hoping that we've learned something from the Exxon Valdez, and I'm hoping it won't be 20 years, but I certainly wouldn't hold my breath.
Sanders will attend the Gulf State Consortium's training conference next week. Alaska Legal Services has 10 offices throughout the state. It provides free legal help to low-income clients in civil matters. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The recent gas line explosion in California has consumers across the nation wondering about the safety of their own neighborhood transmission lines. NSTAR Natural Gas Company serves 130,000 customers in the Matsu Valley, Anchorage, and down the Kenai Peninsula to Anchor Point. John Sims is an NSTAR spokesman. He says NSTAR's system, which started being built in the 1960s, is more contemporary than others in cities in the lower 48.
Because we have a newer system, we have a majority of plastic piping, especially for distribution. And then our transmission lines are higher quality steel than the one that ruptured and blew in California.
Sims says better steel slows corrosion, which he says is the most important factor in pipeline safety. He says the NSTAR system also operates at lower pressure than systems in major cities such as San Francisco.
Another important thing is the quality of gas that we have in Cook Inlet. Because it's what we would classify as a dry gas, almost purely methane, that too leads to less corrosion on the pipe.
Sims says before the accident in California, the federal government mandated integrity inspections for all transmission lines to be completed by 2012. He says NSTAR is ahead of schedule and has 90% of their lines pigged or inspected by sending a sensor through the line that gathers information about wall thickness, an indication of whether or not corrosion is a problem. He says no significant problems have been discovered. Lois Epstein is an engineer and board member of the Pipeline Safety Trust, a nonprofit watchdog group that looks at federal regulations and where they need to be strengthened. She says in reviewing NSTAR's records, things look good.
There haven't been transmission pipeline accidents. There have been some distribution incidents, and that's not surprising because oftentimes the smaller pipelines can be hit by someone with some sort of backhoe or shovel going into the ground, and that's common. But the transmission lines, which are the high-pressure lines, haven't had incidents locally, which is very good to hear.
Epstein says Alaska is unique in that there are no state inspectors here. NSTAR is covered by federal regulations and inspectors.
That's very unusual for gas pipelines. So we're completely reliant on the federal government to inspect and oversee NSTAR. And other states have their own inspectors, and generally that's helpful for ensuring that the state's interests in preventing accidents is addressed.
She says there are only about 100 federal inspectors in the country and 300 state inspectors. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an award-winning seafood processor in Sitka.
There's no blood marks in the flesh, no bruises, and then they're hand-packed in ice in the hole, so it provides a really great quality product.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Republican Bill Walker says he's not continuing a run for the governor's office. He came in second in the Republican primary last month with about a third of the party members' votes. A Creation Research poll conducted the day after the election showed that in a three-person race, he was only one percentage point behind Governor Sean Parnell and 5 points ahead of Democrat Ethan Berkowitz. But Walker never reached agreement with any other party to run as their candidate, and he decided not to actively pursue a write-in candidacy. Since the election, Walker has met with both Parnell and Berkowitz, but for now, he won't endorse any of the other candidates on the general election ballot.
I felt that way. I wouldn't have been in the race to begin with, probably. So I'm still sort of, looking at that, and then I'll be giving some consideration to that. And, it's certainly a possibility I end up not endorsing anybody, and I'm sure that we'll see. We'll see how that plays out. There's plenty of time for that.
Walker's main issue was his support for an all-Alaska gas line from the North Slope. Now both major party candidates are looking for Walker's voters. Democrat Ethan Berkowitz says one of his goals is to deliver the all-Alaska gas project from the North Slope to Tidewater, with Walker's having a hand in negotiating Alaska's gas future.
The pipeline is a big issue in the state. There are other issues that are out there, and I do believe people are tired of business as usual, where it's all about the same old kind of politics and nothing ever gets done. And Sean Parnell represents that kind of politics. And I would encourage people who are frustrated with the way things are that they ought to look at my candidacy and join my campaign. We can win this, and we can turn Alaska in the right direction.
Republican Parnell's running mate, Mead Treadwell, has worked with Walker on the All-Alaska Pipeline dating back to the early 80s. He says since his election in the lieutenant governor's primary race, he has already met with oil company executives, and he says the time is right to bring potential customers from export markets to help work them into the process.
We're ready to sit down with any and all comers on that issue appropriately to see what happens. And I'm not speaking as a state official, but I'm speaking as one who myself has advocated this for some time, and there are opportunities to move forward.
Treadwell says he and Governor Parnell have looked at other issues that Walker raised and are considering taking action on them. On Monday, the U.S. Commerce Secretary announced that another 35 projects will be funded with federal stimulus money to expand broadband internet access across the country. One of those projects will put high-speed broadband internet in almost every public library in Alaska. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Oh, we are very excited. This is great news for Alaska.
That was Alaska State Librarian Linda Thibodeau reacting to the news that Alaska is getting $5.4 million to fund a project to install a broadband network that will link up 104 public libraries across the state. The project is being called Alaska OWL. The OWL stands for Online with Libraries. Thibodeau says expanding high-speed internet access to all libraries is an important priority for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. Thibodeau says a provider for the broadband network has not yet been determined, but work on that project will begin immediately.
As soon as we can get some people hired who will assist us with the project and put the request for proposals forward, we're going to be beginning to roll this out. And we won't be able to do all the libraries at once. So it is going to be over the timeline of a couple of years.
While the federal funding totals $5.4 million, the actual projected cost of the three-year project is $8.2 million. The project includes $2.9 million in matching funds. $1.6 million comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and $250,000 from the Rasmussen Foundation. Thibodeau confirms that all public libraries in Alaska have internet access, but many of them lack high-speed broadband access.
There are so many services and products and things that are moving away from non-internet-based dissemination that it's so important for people to be able to get to the internet to use. And the public libraries, we think, are a great venue because they're open to everybody. They're free. No one has to. You don't have to pay charges. Anybody who wants to can come in and use them.
In many communities across Alaska, the public library serves as a community center, and the new project will create computer centers within those libraries. The Alaska OWL project is expected to create over 60 new part-time jobs for local IT support, and Thibodeau confirms that some participating libraries will be required to expand their hours.
For libraries that are the smaller libraries that are open fewer than 20 hours a week, the requirement will be that they add hours of open time, at least 5 hours.
The Alaska OWL project will be unveiled to library directors and others during a two-day launch meeting that will be held in early December in Anchorage. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. This message is sponsored by the FAA.
A fish processor with its main plant in Sitka is being recognized for its quality and marketing efforts. Seafood Processors Cooperative recently won a Governor's North Star Award for international excellence. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld visited the processor and has the story.
A troller unloads iced coho salmon at the Seafood Producers Cooperative, one of the fish processing plants on Sitka's waterfront. Workers sort the gutted, hand-bled fish as President and CEO Tom McLaughlin looks on.
What that does, there's no blood marks in the flesh, no bruises, and then they're hand-packed in ice in the hold. You can see them unloading fish out of the hold packed in ice. It provides a really great quality product.
The state agrees. Seafood Producers Cooperative is one of six Alaska businesses and organizations that just received Governor's North Star Awards for international excellence. The cooperative has 520 active members. They fish mostly for salmon, halibut, and black cod. McLaughlin says they've all agreed to maintain consistent standards.
Our owner members recognize that you have to handle that fish, get it on ice quickly. So it really starts the vessel. Then when it comes into the plant, we of course have a pretty strict sanitary program, and we also test for bacteria on a daily basis. We do environmental swabs and the whole bit. In other words, you know, we're in the food business. We're not just in the fish business.
The operation is headquartered in a cold storage plant in Bellingham, Washington, and runs the processing facility in Sitka. It began in 1944 and is North America's largest fishermen's cooperative. The State Commerce Department's Patricia Eckert says it's a logical choice for an export award.
They do send about 50 to 60% of their product overseas, and they are helping to build that Alaska brand in key international markets.
The award carries no cash prize, but Eckert says it can help bring attention to the business's products.
I think it's something they can use in communicating to the public, not just in Alaska, but in those international markets, how valuable their seafood is, how good their product is.
But this is our fillet line and vacuum packaging line. We're done running for the day here. We're going to we do a complete sanitation in this room. Every day, we don't run this around the clock. We have a 4 to 6 hour cleanup every day.
Seafood Producers Cooperative processes about 12 million pounds of fish a year at its Sitka plant. McLaughlin says it also has agreements with other packers to handle seafood from its owner members. Total sales last year were a little more than $50 million.
I always tell everybody I have 520 stockholders. Because even though co-op isn't like a publicly held corporation in terms of stock, they own the company. They have a capital investment in the business. And it's our job as a management team and the employees to get them a return on their investment. So the challenge is to provide the return over and above the price they would get from, saying, selling to somebody else.
The cooperative sells about two-thirds of Alaska's troll-caught salmon. It also handles halibut, rockfish, and tuna, and it's expanding its black cod or sablefish market. In another room at the plant, headed, gutted, frozen sablefish spills off a conveyor belt onto a rotating aluminum table. Workers sort it, box it, and load it into freezer vans for quick shipment.
We sell most of this in Asia. However, there's a growing demand here in the United States and even in Europe for black cod. So more of our product is we're being more diversified than where we even sell that.
Another Governor's North Star Export Award went to Western Alaska's Coastal Villages Region Fund, which recently opened an office in Japan. Other awards went to All Alaska Tours, China Airlines, Institute of the North, and the Alaska-Sudan Medical Project. All, except the airline, are based in Anchorage. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka.
A federal historian was in Klukwan last week working to reunite 19th century maps with the descendants of the local people who helped create them. From member station KHNS, Tara Bicknell has the story.
Sometime around 1869, in Klukwan, a Tlingit leader, Koklux, along with his two wives, drew out a set of maps for visiting scientist George Davidson. Yes, the Davidson whose name is now found on modern maps above the Davidson Glacier. Some of those centuries-old charts, though, covered hundreds of miles from the Lynn Canal to the Yukon River. But they haven't been seen in Alaska since 1899, until last week, when one historian made his first trip to Alaska to reunite the artifacts with the creator's descendants. John Cloud is a historian with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, based in Maryland.
Koklux and his two wives, who were sisters from the Stikine River, they were very good cartographers. You know, they knew the country really well, and they drew it in a way that is unique, but is very highly accurate.
It took Cloud 2 years of persuasion to access the National Archives, where most of the major historical records are preserved. When he got in, he began scanning maps people didn't even know about, found hidden away in the government's endless vaults.
And there were a lot of things I knew I wanted to find because I knew about them. And then there were other maps that just showed up. And the Ku Klux map was definitely one of the latter that I, and as soon as I saw it, wow. It's really crude, like rocky mountains, all the mountains.
In a presentation last week in Klukwan, Cloud described the process of getting the maps for viewing.
And the neat thing about them is, well, they're big and heavy. I mean, they're paper backed by linen. They tend to be 5 feet by 3 feet.
George Davidson, for whom the maps were originally drawn, worked for the Coast Survey for almost 50 years. And he was sent to the West Coast to map after the U.S. acquired California after the Mexican War.
Davidson got a telegraph. Go up to this place called Russian America and check out this crazy idea to buy it. He went to Sitka. Ku Klux happened to be in town. Davidson knew there would be a total eclipse of the sun in 1869 and planned to, he wanted to come back for that. And it was going to be visible in the upper Chilcot Valley. So it was, there was a cosmic intersection between Ku Klux and his wives and George Davidson.
Davidson was known for his sensitivity and sympathy towards Native cultures, and documents show that the Coast Survey tried to preserve the place names as they were known by the people living there.
And one of the things that they made a point of, and this shows up in official reports, is pay particular attention to local place names, particularly Indian place names, and do your best to spell them consistently and correctly, so that if you do your work right, the charts that we make with those names will themselves become the best historical authority. And the Ku Klux map is like that, I think.
And there's the Bancroft one.
That's the Bancroft one. That's
a fascinated crowd gathered at last week's village council meeting to look at the drawings in Klukwan. The village now has digital copies and is working with Cloud to acquire the original mapping.
And so it's another world that came down, and many changes. And many changes at Klukwan and many changes elsewhere. So it's a look into a world that was about to change a great deal.
They welcomed the forgotten artifact with strange curiosity. I'm Tara Bicknell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka, and Tara Bicknell in Haines. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.